Hi. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, August 23rd, 1996. In the fireside room this morning, our speakers are Jeff and Emily Kirsten Greep. Today they will be continuing their series entitled Communication and Gender. Today's session number is 5 and is titled Raising Our Children in a Gendered Society. Let's listen in.
Good morning, everybody.
See
you all here on this beautiful, warm, sunny day. Today is the last day in our 5-day series of talking about gender and communication. And yesterday, as Jeff pointed out, we've done a lot of different styles of facilitating this. We've done some, you know, back and forth MTV stuff. We've done some chunks each. And yesterday, Jeff did really everything. And today, I'm going to do most of it. So we're sort of doing this trade-off thing. How many are here for the first time for one of these classes in this series? Okay, there are a few of you. So real quickly,
welcome.
Yeah, welcome. We're glad you're here. My name's Emily Kirsten Grip. I'm a social worker in Tacoma, Washington. I work with families and children where there's been abuse or neglect. This is today's topic, which is about how are we going to raise our children and what do we do with this next generation, is one that's real close to my heart and one I've thought a lot about. So I'm real excited for today. Jeff can introduce himself.
My name is Jeff. I'm married to Emily. We have the same last name, which is Kirsten Grip, not Kirsten Grip or Kirsten Gripe or Greep, as we've been hearing all week. I'm just kind of waiting for somebody to get it right. It's been kind of an adventure just to sort of listen to announcements to see who will be today. As we said, we've been doing this series all week, and just a recap for the few of you who haven't been here, just a couple minute recap. I teach speech communication, and I have been doing that at the university level for 12 years. So I started when I was 12.
If anybody picks up on anything that doesn't smell real good, we just did garble.
Yeah.
We raced home and squished off as best we could, but if, you know. Sorry.
It's not the subject matter that stinks.
Truly.
And one other thing, before I give you a little recap and then sit out of the way for the day, is I was approached by a couple people yesterday that said if you just wanted some beginning resources, what would they be? So here are the resources we've primarily been working from. If you're curious about these are 3 books. The first one is a text called Gendered Lives. Very recent, it's from 94. The second is something from the popular press written by a sociolinguist who actually does research and doesn't just think about what would be cool and write it down, Deborah Tannen, You Just Don't Understand. And a third one, which is considered kind of a classic, Carol Gilligan's In a Different Voice. Emily's going to mention some stuff about her today, challenging the male standard that what men do is normal and therefore what women do is a little bit off of normal. And she studied a lot of kids to figure that out, so it's three interesting sources. What have we done this week? First day, we got together and talked with each other about notions of masculine and feminine. What does it mean to be masculine and feminine in America? And we talked about gender as socially constructed and something that we do with each other on an interpersonal basis. It's not just biology, it's not just society, it's primarily what goes on between us interpersonally that makes us who we are in terms of our gender. And we argued about that a little bit. Second day, we talked about the sources of messages about gender. We hear from our parents, our peers, our teachers, the media, of course. We filter that through all 3 of those other sources. And in addition to sources of messages, we also talked about how the mode by which those messages get to us, communication and language, is also kind of it's not a value-free mode. There are values implicit in the talk that we use and the ways that we treat each other. We're really using a very dynamic process when we communicate with one another. Third day, what did we talk about? Third day, we talked about styles, men's and women's styles of communicating, some reliable, typical things that masculine and feminine language users ordinarily do, and some points of friction where those often come into contact. Yesterday, as most of you know, we finally got around to asking, what should we do next? What are we called to do? And we really got to the practical level. We addressed some of the practical problems, for instance, unnecessary tension in relationships, or maybe wanting to show respect but not hearing respect. And the theme that we sort of left you with and left as sort of a challenge that I guess wasn't really addressed last night in the forum very much. I was doing childcare last night, so I didn't get to go. I had a really fun night, though. I don't want to make it sound like it was drudgery. It was really fun. is we didn't address the theme of violence, that there is violence that results, at least in part, from the ways we name and speak and hear each other in terms of our genders, and that that's something that we're going to pick up on a little bit today as we talk about how to raise our kids. And again, it's going to be a heavy day for you. I'm going to have you talking a lot, and we'll be listening and facilitating. In particular, Emily will be listening and facilitating, and I'll be listening.
Okay.
Enough?
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. I asked Jeff to do that because he is so good at pulling things together. And
don't I just hold the floor and give myself status?
He stands on his chair. How can you miss it? So, but I asked him to do that because he does tie it up real well. But now I want to sort of back up and do a chance for everybody one last time to do a little bit. They're called icebreakers. But when you get a chance to talk to people around you. But the question, today I'm going to ask you to do something pretty different. I'm going to ask you a question, and I want you to think about it for a minute, and then I want you to turn to someone, not necessarily a partner or a friend who's here with you, but someone who's sitting near. I don't want to disrupt the whole room, and I do want to give us more than just a couple of minutes for this, because I think it's a pretty interesting question, and I want you to think about it pretty hard. Is that? Oh, that must be the bus. Okay. It's like, is my watch that far off? But the question I want you to think about and talk to a neighbor about is, how would your life be different if you woke up tomorrow and your sex were changed?
Not your gender,
your sex. If tomorrow you woke up and you were, if I woke up tomorrow and I were a man, Jeff woke up tomorrow and he were a woman, how would your life be different? So think about that for a minute and grab somebody near you and introduce yourselves, and so you have another face you know. But talk about that for a minute. Think about that. What would be different? Sounds like you all had a lot of ideas and thoughts. Really felt like things would be different. Okay. I just want to real quickly have people tell me some of the things, the first things that popped into their heads when I asked the question, and for those who wandered in a little later, the question was, if you woke up tomorrow and you were the opposite sex, how would your life be different in our society today? So what sort of things got said? What sort of things were your first responses? Oh, okay, over here. Just one line quick. Okay.
We agreed we'd have the freedom of choices. We could do anything we really wanted to do.
Okay, so women think they'd have more choices.
This wasn't my answer, but I have to say, make more money.
Yeah. Okay. Wait. As a woman, I'd have to take up less space in my chair.
Yeah. That's an interesting thing
to take off. As a woman, I would have to balance raising a family and professional career.
Yeah.
Something that I don't have to confront now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I saw some hands over here.
Wouldn't you have to wear a bra or a pantyhose?
All right. What others? Yeah. Oh, boy, those lines. Yeah.
Very little change.
Very little change?
We wouldn't. You do things about
you didn't
the
think
same.
You thought things would stay pretty much the same for you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I sure wouldn't be breastfeeding my son.
Good point. Any others, real quickly, or?
Leaving clothes, getting ready in the morning.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So what I'm hearing generally is that if you were born a woman, you'd have more constraints, and if you were born a man, you'd have fewer, is the sense, people. That's what I'm hearing come out of the conversation. Well, interestingly enough, that's just this wonderful little segue into talking about kids. A study was done a few years ago with kids who were in third grade up through 12th grade, and they asked them exactly that question. And that's pretty much what the kids said. I referred to this earlier this week. Little boys, one of the first things little boys said was, I'd want to be pretty. Because I know that if you aren't pretty, you know, as a little girl, you're not going to get as far. Little girls and girls all the way up through 12th grade talked about how much quicker they could get ready for school in the morning if they weren't a girl. No pantyhose and bras. And things like that. So that's the perception that we all have of what it means to be of the opposite sex. There's a real sense that women have, you know, they take up less space, They don't make as much money. They're doing all of those things, and that men can sort of spread out, that they can do whatever they want. And I'm not saying that this is true. I'm talking about what our perceptions are of what's out there for us. But I think the point I want to make is that we all carry those around with us, and I think that's a great question because I think it's an important one, and I love to hear people who feel like their lives aren't going to change very much, because I think that that's an interesting thing to be able to get to know that you're right there. But I think also that we need to recognize that little boys and little girls pick up on this stuff really early. And I think that what I'd like to talk about and think about today is, number one, how early we start doing it and thinking about it and starting to put people into gendered roles. Yesterday we talked some about the damage that does. I'd like to talk about that some more. And then, before too long, and I'm going to move through this pretty fast and I'm going to give you some information, but what I really want to get to today is talking about, yesterday we used the metaphor of communication being a dance, and how can we teach both ourselves and our children to do that dance in a way that is the most graceful and is the most helpful and is the most nurturing for everyone. Very feminine word. Oops. Nurturing. But, and powerful and strong. So, all those things. So, but what I want to talk about is, first, real quickly, these pieces of information and research. When children are born into a society that has this split between gendered identities that are, at least initially as children, before you have any choices about it, really split down the lines of whether you're a boy or a girl. It's early, it's prevalent, and it's just prevalent. It's in everything. It's in what we dress our children in. I work in early childhood. It's nothing more painful than to watch a little child who's trying to learn how to crawl who's been put in a dress. You can't crawl in a dress. No. Your knees catch on it. You can't move. It slows you down. You can't learn to walk if you wear a dress because you step on the dress when you're trying to get up off your knees. Real subtle things that I don't think a lot of us take into account when we look at how we treat our children. Even just the real basics, if it's a boy, you're putting him in blue, and if it's a girl, you're going to put her in pink. Those old traditional things. And those are subtle. They're not maybe, you know, I'm certainly they're arguably not as powerful as some of the other things. The things that I find most interesting and that I think we need to look at hard is the new research out that says from the day a baby is born, when they look at the how they interact with parents, we talk to our baby girls more. We interact with them more. We look at them face to face more, and we talk to them more. We're teaching girls early on, and it happens in hospitals with nurses. I mean, right from the day you're born, if you're a girl, people are going to start to interact with you face to face. It's not the shoulder to shoulder stuff that we do with boys. It's face to face. We talk to our girls more. Girls are learning very, very early that language and communication are the way to develop relationship. Boys are being cared for, but they aren't being communicated with in the same ways. So I think that's an important thing for all of us to think about and know that at least that goes on. As we grow up, our play changes. Our play is very different, and that's, I think a lot of you have probably seen or heard research on that. I'm not asking for feedback right now. Does anybody want to comment on that? Anybody raised babies that wants to? Yeah.
You just affirmed something. You know, when your children are grown up, and then you begin to think about all the things you did wrong. But our son, who's 27 years old, I talked to him a lot, mm-hmm. partly because I was so young when he was born. We mm-hmm. were both sort of children together. And so he's very verbal, and he talks face to face. It doesn't matter what gender he's speaking to. Mm-hmm. But he gets a lot of teasing for that because he tends to talk more than masculine is expected mm-hmm. to. Mm-hmm. And he gets a lot of, could you make this story shorter?
You know that one. Yeah. Okay. And do you think that you did him a disservice then?
No.
Okay.
He handles that teasing just fine. He accepts that's just part of who he is. Mm-hmm. If you don't like to listen, leave the room.
There you go. Anybody else have any thoughts on that or
confirmation?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can I add something?
What?
Just one little thing? But these are central tendencies too.
Right.
This isn't
yes. Right.
Every case.
Definitely. And I think what you pointed out, there are also those differences when, I mean, a first child has a lot more, we have a lot more time and energy to do that interaction, I think. Other pieces that I think are real, that come in and are pretty prevalent. One of the things that I have had happen here at Holden, because this is the first time I've been around big groups of people who haven't met Tori before and haven't met us, is the number of people whose comment to us about Tori is how pretty she is. And I do think she's beautiful. But it's interesting to me that I don't know that if she were a boy, people would be complimenting me on how she looked. And so that's just one of those things to think about. I had to think about it when I started being an aunt. Because I thought my nieces were so gorgeous. And that's all I had for a long time. But my sister pointed out that her daughter was so often being old, all people talked about was how pretty she was. They didn't talk about how strong she was or how coordinated or how well she used words or anything like that. Their first comment was that real surface one. And I'm not sure we do that to boys as much, but I'm not sure. Yeah.
We've talked about this before.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But my son, people have said that he's beautiful. Is it okay if I say that? It's like, if he's beautiful to you, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Mm-hmm. It's not because he's a boy he can't be attractive or look like it. Any other kid, whether male or female, just
kind of
around
the chubby. Yeah, and I guess I'm not trying. He really is a Winston Churchill. But I do think that, you know, and I'm not trying to advocate that we don't talk about how beautiful these physical beings are, because I think that's an important piece too, probably especially for girls.
Yeah. I would just say as a follow-up to that, I think then it's okay to say that babies are beautiful and young children, but then there's this age, and I don't know, it happens maybe between 2, maybe between 5, mm-hmm. where you start to see a split.
Sure.
And they still say the girls are beautiful, but they don't say that those beautiful baby boys are beautiful anymore. And it's just something that kind of happens. And the same thing that I've noticed in our child care co-op is the kids all used to play together, and then something happened, and the kids split, and the girls were all doing something, and some of the girls cross over and do what the boys are doing, but the boys' play is different.
Yeah. Good segue. Thank you. Because I was going to talk about play next, but go ahead.
It just kind of occurred to me then that if not all little girls are beautiful, and perhaps those girls, then you look for other things to say, and you it's almost, not to say it's an advantage, but you reinforce some of their other abilities, so you can compliment them too, and that they may have something that the attractive ones don't have in their abilities. You do compliment them on their strength and the gymnastics and things.
I've got two people, and you're right behind each other, so you can...
I would say the one piece of that, although, is that if there is a little girl who is perhaps not perceived as being beautiful and not talked about that a lot, while it may be helpful that other attributes are encouraged in a culture that places so much emphasis on physical beauty of women, that can be a real problem in terms of self-image.
Yeah.
I just wondered why there needed to be a comment about the way the child looks at all.
Mm-hmm.
Handicapped people have a terrible time with all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that we are taught, those of us that aren't handicapped visibly, to treat that is to simply say to our child, that person uses a chair to get around. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have wheels on their chair.
Mm-hmm.
And so when my grandson first was introduced to the great-grandmother in the wheelchair, she didn't have the wheelchair when he first was around her, and then she was in the wheelchair, so and he just said, "Grandma has wheels!" I mean, it was wonderful,
mm-hmm.
and it was just this flat statement, but I heard her say that somebody was asking permission to compliment her child, but really to compliment her and not hurt her feelings. I mean, is it okay if I say your baby's beautiful if it's a boy?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. I know, and it's really funny because Tori's adopted. I always think, and I have absolutely, you know, it feels like people are complimenting me on how my daughter looks.
It's
like, this is a God-given thing. And it really is clearly not something I had anything to do with.
I
So, but it is, I think, also, though, the idea that I guess I wouldn't want to say we never complimented the beauty of the human body either. I'd like to think that we can find
the value beauty of it. It's how much importance we're going to continue to put on these things. And we are society. And, you know, that it's up to us to decide that we're not going to value each other so much on the outward appearance. But reading Reviving Ophelia talks about when we become such a huge group of people that we don't know each other other than on outward appearance. We've got to really work on, you know, it's a complicated issue. Mm-hmm.
Not to get you too far off the point there, really, but I think there's another element of that too that we talked about early on in our parenting of just compliments toward the children in general as something the parents say thank you for. Now, why is it the parents say thank you if someone says your child is beautiful? The parents didn't make the child beautiful. And if you want to acknowledge, you know, somehow, you know, gratitude for the creator, generosity in this aspect of beauty, just like with a flower or a sunset, you know, we wouldn't say thank you personally for that as if it said something about our self-esteem, our value. And, you know, I think it has a lot to do with how we think of our children as extensions of ourselves and creations of ourselves.
Mm-hmm. I'm just curious to think what would a better response be?
Yeah,
as I say,
mm-hmm. Yeah, too.
Did you talk that? Did you get that far?
I think she's beautiful, too. Oh. Or something like that.
I tend to say that because I really don't take any credit. Isn't she?
I always felt kind of uncomfortable with compliments like that, and I made an effort, and still do, to direct our comments of praise, for example, or criticism to our children on the basis of things that they do, mm-hmm. and not what they are or what they look like or any of that sort of thing. And I think we've made a conscious effort to do that with both of them. Mm-hmm. A daughter who just wandered through and she's 12 and our 14-year-old son. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What would be a better community response? I would be interested in knowing what parents would like to hear. I mean, I could turn around and say, I can see you're really taking good care of that kid. Mm-hmm. And because the child is beautiful, mm-hmm. you know.
Maybe tell the baby that they're beautiful. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I would love to have people tell Tori they think she's smart, or that they think she's coordinated, or that they think, you know, just as a parent. That's just one thing. And I think of that because I work in early childhood. Uh-huh. So I think a lot about how much we talk over children's heads mm-hmm. instead of directly to them. So that's just one idea. Are there others?
Good question.
That is a real good question. Because, and there's that individual community response. We individually do that. That's not really a community response.
I don't want to persist, but I have said things to children in stores. They'll be admiring something, and I'll say something too. And I saw this in a cartoon where the grown man says something to the strange child, and all of a sudden, the next picture, the child's in mommy's arms going like this, you know, looking at him, and he's going, like, what's the world coming to? I can't even speak to a child, a grown man to a little girl.
Just to build on something that was whispered behind me, maybe you said, was that we need to know each other better.
Yeah.
That, so we have more to say about the people around us. We don't just, I don't know you very well. I've spent a week with a lot of you, but I really don't know more than what you look like in a lot of cases. So I could say, ooh, nice mustache, Jerry. You know, I don't really know a lot of things about each of you.
We
and maybe
all
it's my
alike.
Responsibility, it's incumbent upon us to get to know the people we live near. How well do you know your neighbors? And so that we have more things to say about each other and with each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me get way out of left field, is that many of the things we're talking about here with raising children applies also as you deal with older people who are going down the slope rather than climbing up the slope. We stereotype them, we say, oh, you're doing very well, or you paddle that wheelchair great, or whatever. But we treat them, in many ways, just like infants. And it gets more and more.
No, we talk over them.
We talk over them?
Not to them.
You don't talk to them?
Good point. I'm gonna take one more, and then I'm gonna kind of keep rolling. So we can.
I was in an angel making class yesterday, and there was one little girl on it that was there without any parents, and she was kind of ignored. My husband and I just, you know, kind of helping her. The rest of the people just, it's almost, it is like, And my father's in a rest home, and they, it is kind of the same thing. You're like not there if you're a child or if you're another person.
I think that's a real important point. That is this, and I think it shows up politically, too. I mean, this keeps carrying out and out and out. What I want to do is jump, because there are a lot of provocative things to think about today, and I hope that if anything, today we all leave with a whole lot more to talk about, and we're still here for about 24 hours, and we'd love to be part of the conversations that continue that you take home with you. What I want to go to is something that Maggie brought up just a minute ago about the differences in how children play. And that also starts quite young. Boys, when they play, and I want nods or some sort of affirmation from men in the room, if this reflects their early play and ongoing play, I would say, that they're, number one, three characteristics. They tend to involve fairly large groups. I mean, look at football teams. How many are on football teams now?
Lots.
30. I don't know. You know, but 9 baseball players on a field. They tend to include quite a few people. They're competitive, and they have clear rules, goals, and roles. You play a certain part within that. You know, you're on a team, you're the catcher, and there's something you do. There are rules, and you're doing these things. And what they say is the communication rules, I wrote here, and the rules that you learn from that, so that you cultivate and you take out into how you communicate with other people in the world, are the things about you use communication to assert yourself and your ideas, that you use communication to attract and maintain an audience, get people to look at you, to pay attention, and you use communication to compete with other people for the talk stage. So what you do is you learn to get and hold the floor. One of the examples that they use is how if you're watching a group of young boys play a game, they've got rules, they know how it's supposed to go. If they're going to have, I don't know, I'm trying to think of a good example. Maybe in a baseball game, whether it was a foul or not. They might, you know, you might have everybody out on the field yelling at each other about whether that was a foul or not. Generally, how it would be resolved is that with a do-over would be kind of the major compromise, is that you do it over and you do it again. But the game continues, you know? It's sort of, you get in there, you fight, you say, no, 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 you know, no, it wasn't, yes, it was, no, it wasn't, yes, it was. Well, we'll do over, you know, and back to the game everybody goes. And that's, so it's the shoulder to shoulder, it's playing together, it's doing things. Alternately, girls tend to play in smaller groups, play often in pairs, just two together. The characteristics are, and also that there are no clear-cut rules and goals and roles. You play house, you negotiate that whole thing. You have to talk to each other. You've got to decide who's going to be the mom, who's going to be the baby, who's going to feed, what you're going to do, if you're going to go places, if you're not going to go places. It's all talk. It's all negotiation. The communication rules that get cultivated by that kind of play is that you use to learn collaborative and cooperative talk. You work to create and maintain the relationships between you as you're playing so that the game can continue. You have to keep talking because, geez, something new is happening here. How are we going to keep it going? You avoid outdoing or criticizing or putting the other person, the other people you're playing with down. That doesn't mean girls never do those things, but they don't do it face-to-face, and they don't do it in the course of the game together. They're not going to do it right then and there. And they learn to pay attention to others and relationships. You're paying attention to feelings. We want the game to continue. So as boys may have a big fight about whether a rule was broken or not, then they all go back to the game. With girls, they would, in the research I've read, and I'm referring to, girls would tend to quit playing the game before they would really fight in a way that might break relationship. So you might just say, well, let's just go outside now. You know, let's go play on the swing set for a while instead, or whatever. And so they're going to change what they do instead. So now, what I'd like to do is let you talk a little bit about that. Does that feel true to you? Does that feel like where you've watched other children, you know, when you've watched children play and observed children play, does that feel true? Was it true for your own experience? Is that, does that ring true?
Mm-hmm. It's true out of the gate, and it's true after they finish the race.
So you feel like it stays with us?
You bet.
Okay, that those are learned. Okay.
I think that one thing that's really changing kids' lives is girls' sports. Yeah. Mm. And I think the longer that girls are exposed to organized sports from a young age, you know, starting with t-ball at grade 5, and getting on to the best teams all through high school, the more those stereotypes are leaving. And it may be something that happens in preschool, but if they plug into it and buy into that system in elementary school, you know, high school girls are not the same as they were 20 years ago.
Yeah, when you went to high school, how many sports did they have for girls?
Well, cheerleading.
Yeah, cheerleading. Cheerleading was the sport.
Yeah. So that's really changed.
Mm-hmm. Other? Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I echo that. And a phenomenon, I guess, the last quarter century principally. And both of our kids have played baseball, and they continue to play soccer and have since they were about 5. And they both play pretty competitively. Although there are interesting effects that I see. For instance, when a player gets hurt, the game typically doesn't stop immediately. And on the boys' side, they'll usually just kind of jump over the kid while he's lying on the ground and he's gone. Whereas on the girls' side, they'll develop a little cluster of girls from both teams, while the game is still going on, sitting down and just trying to be there and be with the injured player. It's this interesting little dichotomy of behavior from the super competitive, which is what they are when they're playing. There really is no difference. No difference in roughness, no difference in anything. But this bringing out of I guess what we have characterized as a feminine style of behavior.
And I think that's what's tougher for girls now, though, because what you're saying, but there's no guidelines for them, and they're still getting the mixed message of still be cute when you're out there. You know, you guys still have your hair look just fine, and you still want the boys to, you don't want to, you know, so I think, because my daughter's very competitive, and I think she's really struggling and wants to be athletic, but now, and she always played with the boys, and now she's in sixth grade, and third grade was kind of the cutoff. She always played with the boys, and then the boys didn't want her in their play anymore, and then to fit in with the girls, and really the social messages that she's getting, that it's been tough, it's been confusing. So, but I agree with you that the girls, I don't think she'll really experience all that I did, because she is getting the snooks, but it's still, We think that they're getting more, but I think they're getting, especially for girls, it's a bigger mixed bag now. And I fear for my, you know, I'm concerned. That's why I'm here, and I'm so excited for you with being a new parent. Your joy, because I feel like I was there, but now I've been kind of through the trenches, and I want to get that enthusiasm back.
The trenches?
I find it really interesting to think about this discussion about girls entering team sports and how that's maybe bringing some different modes of communication into their play. I'm wondering if people are seeing examples. I am not, and I think it's tragic, and I think it's actually, and thinking about these are our housemates, so this little boy lives with me. And what sorts of opportunities are there out there, or are there, that are encouraging boys to be in nurturing kind of play situations, the one-on-one, encouraging those sorts of skills.
Okay, I think there was a hand over here. Yeah.
Well, when I was growing up as a young person, I was in a farm area, and we had one mile of road where there were several farms, and every evening after chores, they'd all come down to our place because we had queued out an infield in our hayfield. Mm-hmm. We played softball till it was dark, and there were like a half a dozen girls and a dozen boys, and it was workup softball, so you had to play by the rules. And the girls, they all fit in, but eventually they were known as tomboys because they played by the rules with the boys.
I really like the point Jeannie brought up, and I guess I'm happy to keep hearing things, but I'd love to not lose that, so we don't lose that one, because it does feel like that's an important point.
Okay,
Karen, then here.
Well, how about the child before Little League and the pre-stuff? Did your survey say anything about that? Because we always say bring up a child to 5, and a lot of this pre that is very influential. Does that come back later, or is that really there as we submerged under.
I want to be sure I understand.
The socialization of the sports and the games that you were explaining is really a socialization. So what about the child right before that? Do you have anything in your survey?
Mostly what it says, when, and I don't, you know, I don't have the stuff with me. And it really comes down to which side of the mix you're on, if you think it's mostly biological or mostly cultural and, you know, psychological and all those sorts of things. Girls and boys tend to play together and play well together until, who said the third grade? I mean, that's a big drawing line, but there's an earlier line too in early childhood. Probably around the ages, in 4 or 5, children really start to understand themselves as either a boy or a girl. So that's the first time that they really understand themselves as physically different. You know, that there's sort of this thing. And so kids up until then often get mixed up, even about what their own sex is. And they don't understand that as a split. They can play together really well. And their play stays quite similar if they are given a similar environment. And that's really the key. When you have, in the studies they've done with children who've come in, and, you know, I think Maggie was talking, oh, and she's got to leave. But, you know, talking about an experience in which she feels like there was a real separation even though the children were really being raised in similar ways. I think we need to study it a lot more. I think we need to look at that a lot more closely. But I do believe, quite seriously, even without more research, that even if there are some differences that are there because of our biology that we don't quite understand completely now, the repertoire is way too narrow right now. That even though at an early age, you know, we always have the people who can tell stories. Someone, oh, she's not here today. Who had the little girl who took, took the doll, was given a truck and took the truck driver out and cradled the truck driver. And never did play with the truck. You're going to find anecdotal things like that. But you also will find many girls who would prefer to play in the block area, but because teachers allow boys to be a little bit rougher, it becomes a kind of dangerous place to be. And I think we send real subtle messages about which is the appropriate part of the room to be in. Teachers tend to talk to little boys more in preschool. They tend to sit down with them and work on puzzles and work on building things more if there are real differences in that. Jeff wanted to say something. I know lots of people have comments now.
So. I'm going to say something really brief, and that is somebody walked with me up the stairs last night and said, you know, we didn't have courses like this when I was in college. It was a person maybe one generation removed from me. And that shows, I mean, it's not, there's a joke in academia that you end every study you ever write up with, further research needs to be done. It's a really safe statement to make. But in this case, I think it's really true. This is really new. To sort of figure out these ways of speaking and then to think about, well, when did we learn these? And what are all the different ways that we get these messages? That this really is pretty new, a new area to focus on when we start to see them. Words like sexual harassment, did you know what that meant 20 years ago?
10.
Like gay bashing. Things like that are coming into our lexicon because we're starting to pay attention to them and we've named them. And now that we've named them, we want to know them. Thank you.
Okay, we're gonna cruise around this way, maybe. Okay. Okay. There are so many hands. Okay.
Talking about boy behavior, and echoing your comment and the narrowness of allowed behaviors, we've always tried to emphasize to our kids mutual respect and sensitivity towards other person's feelings. And our son is at the stage now at 14 where he'll sometimes come after some kind of public situation and say something to the effect, I really felt sorry for what happened to so-and-so, but, and then just as the situation was that I really couldn't express it because it wouldn't be appropriate male behavior in that circle of people. So he's at that stage where he now sees some of the tension between the ideals that you've tried to pass on to him and the realities of the peer situation.
Small as the point.
You're asking about what you can do to help allow boys have more an environment where they can engage in nurturing behavior. I think what worked in our family was dolls were never really that much of interest, but stuffed animals were a big hit.
Yes.
And I think the boys might feel more comfortable nurturing or doing role-playing and games with stuffed animals than perhaps dolls, maybe because they're just more neutral by themselves. Yes. So that's something to think about. Yes. In fact, we've had... you know, occasionally we've gotten Barbie dolls, clothes, and toys and things like that. The dolls get ignored, but they take the Barbie doll clothes and the Ken clothes and put them on their little stuffed animals. But maybe it's a more neutral, less shiny.
Okay, let's keep
My son came out of the, he's 27, he came out of the closet like a year ago, and now as I look back on things, I can see where he had these, the more tendencies to, you know, play in the one-on-one group with another, one other person. A lot of times he played with a girl, and in nursery school, of course, and so, I mean, I think from a very early age, I had it in the back of my mind that maybe he was, but I mean, I...
That sounds like me, growing up. That's all I was going to say.
I don't know, maybe I had a very peculiar childhood, but we were two boys and two girls, and we did all the same things together. Mm-hmm. We went fishing together, we made doll clothes together, we learned to cook together, we did everything together. Mm-hmm. And that was for a long time. I can remember 10, 12 years old, we were still doing things together.
Do you feel like that gave you a broader repertoire, a more fullness and wholeness in yourself?
The other point I'd like to make is that we tend to commit the sin of allness. You know, everyone this, all boys this, all girls that. Not every boy is a successful athlete.
Right.
And I think one of the, I get on my soapbox, I think one of the biggest crimes we've committed against children today is to organize sports. Mm-hmm. Is that there's nothing worse than Little League baseball for the people who can't compete in that. Now, we had sandlot stuff. We just gathered together and we did things, and we made up the rules different every time.
So you're not opposed to the game, just the organization of the game, just sort of it's the same everywhere.
Well, Little League's bad for the parents, too.
Yeah. Okay, I've got two people waiting back. They've been very patient.
I guess two comments. I have a nephew who's going to be 5, and he's in preschool. The boys play on one side of the room, the girls played on the other side of the room, and Nathan sat in the middle, creating a spot where he's invited everybody to play. And it didn't matter if you're male or female. What I find interesting is and I haven't talked to my brother and sister-in-law about this, but what did they affirm in that? That he cared about their feelings, or was he a mediator? And those are two very different ways of looking at that situation. I'm kind of interested, as a result of this conversation, to ask them that, because a mediator would create a sort of a successful potential job for himself as a caring individual. And the other thing I was going to say is that my husband and I, he didn't play sports. I played sports because I came in under the Title IX in the 8th grade, and I was very competitive and very good at what I did. And we've talked about this. It's your job to teach him how to be a potter and a poet and a philosopher, and it's my job to teach him what it means to be a competitor but a sensitive person in that process and all those kinds of things, and some role reversals there as far as what society expects of us.
Yeah. Okay.
It was funny that you brought up the stuffed animal question, because that's exactly what I did as a child with my brother, with two of us, and my parents were very radical in their parenting, I think unintentionally. I think some of it was intentional, but a lot of it was really way before, you know, lots of these things were being discussed. I'm 32. And one of the things that happened is that we had, all of our toys were common. We did not have toys that belonged to me and toys that belonged to my brother. Part of that had to do with our income, which was pretty low. And the major things that we played with were massive stuffed animals and blocks. We built things a lot with blocks, and we would put on weddings and community things, and we'd dress up all the stuffed animals and do these sorts of things. And my brother was probably my best friend for a good chunk of my life. And in our home, we were nurtured and encouraged to be strong and powerful children, and were very comfortable. The problem was, however, when we left that space and went out into the peer group, And I think that our childhood and our childhood play has served us very well as adults. But to be a child that was growing up like that in that time, and I think it's not changed that much today, put back into a peer group, I think that's one of the things as parents, and I'm not a parent yet, just being a significant adult in a lot of children's lives, they have to be aware of. If you're going to make choices to try and raise your child in a different setting, you're going to have to be especially sensitive and spend a lot of energy of supporting them in the peer group, because both of us had lots of problems being in peer groups. I was too strong, too verbal, too something to be a girl. John was too sensitive, too quiet, too like to read, to be a boy. And we struggled with that through both of us, really, until college.
You're absolutely right.
And then in marriage as well.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Good. I want to do just a quick process question. I've got a series of questions I wanted to put out right near the end, and it seems like where we're going is to answer a part of it. But I also really like what we're hearing from each other. So maybe what we could do is continue our conversation here, and I'll leave you with those questions with that. Or do you want to hear some more of what... I guess I'm asking the group to give me some idea. I really like what we're hearing, and maybe what I'll do is just put this out because I do think it's what we're addressing. What I was going to ask you to do in small groups, but I think we're doing in a large group right now, and I'd like to continue doing, is to sort of, we're naming the problem, but people are also starting to talk about ways in which we can begin to show or ourselves learned ways to do this communication dance in ways that aren't so separated. Where we aren't in such separate places. And I want to continue that part of the conversation now, so if I could ask you, I know y'all have ideas and thoughts, but if we could start directing our thoughts more toward how might this look, how might we start putting it together in ways that help children and ourselves do this dance in a way that lets all pieces of the communication soup get mixed in.
I think one thing I haven't heard a lot about is the radically changing face of the family and the fact that many children are growing up in single-parent homes. Mm-hmm. Tack onto that, the church, I wasn't here yesterday, mm-hmm. so I don't know if you talked about it, but it mm-hmm. seems to me it's a marvelous, that's what we bring, is a community that is not just all isolates, where we can be parents and grandparents to other people's kids, and I think we have such a privilege in the church to do that, to look at ways that we can creatively encourage healthy children, mm-hmm. and it's not going to solve everything, but it's at least a place where we could do it, that the language is there, the approach is there, and it take seriously the fact that we're not growing up isolated.
Yeah. So we're a community, and there's more models than who you live with in your house, and that we can offer that modeling to more than our own children. So people like Jeannie wouldn't grow up feeling like there was no one else in her peer group or no one else in her parents' peer group mm-hmm. who understood how she was growing up.
And I think kids give to the elderly give to the kids. That's how you begin to dance gracefully, I think, as people.
Mm-hmm. Good. Other thoughts on that? Because that was going to be my next question. How are we going to model? And how are we going to be sure that new communication styles and new things get modeled? And that's a really important question to me right now. I was saying to Jeff yesterday that out of this week, the thing I'm really having to come to terms with is when I really look at all these things and think about them, I'm almost entirely a feminine communicator. And I'm raising a little girl now, and if I don't want her to be that narrow, I need to look at my repertoire and maybe broaden it. And what was your comment when I told you that? It was something pretty smart.
Probably something pretty smart.
No, it was like, oh darn. I said, well, yes, it is oh darn, because I don't want to change. I like how I communicate. I'm comfortable with it. It's how I've always communicated. I don't especially want to. But if I don't want her to have to relearn, I need to take pretty seriously that she lives in a world with people who learn different patterns, and that are able to express other pieces of themselves that I keep inside because I don't know how to express them effectively.
But take your partnership. That's what Jeff's there for.
Well, no, I'll use
together. You're both parents.
Right, but she also, I think, needs to see, I want her to be a mix. I don't want her to think, well, when I grow up, I'll be one or the other. Right.
No,
mom's
no.
one and dad's one, and I'll be one or the other. I want her to see two people who can do both. That's my challenge.
But you don't have to do both, and Jeff doesn't have to do both. Together, you can give her a heritage.
Right, I agree, but I need to get a broader repertoire, I think. I do. Yeah, and then...
One of the differences that we struggle with, Maggie and I struggle with in having a five-year-old boy in this culture is that not that long ago, when the gender roles and things were clear, parental modeling was reinforced everywhere else. You know, so if mommy stayed home, et cetera, then everybody's mommy stayed home, et cetera. Well, now, when there's such a diversity, I really struggle with understanding how much our son Peter, you know, how much our authority as modelers, not in the command and control sort of authority, but how much weight our model has on him when he sees so many other models that are different. Just because we do it this way doesn't make it right when so many other people do it other ways. One particular example, we don't watch TV. Nobody we know has guns. Ever since Peter's been 3 years old, every stick is a gun. He's been killing things symbolically and imaginatively play since he was three. Now, what do? He said, we don't approve of killing. Or do we not buy him any guns? Well, the two kids we know that have boys that have guns who finally give in are the people we know who are most committed to nonviolence. They found that it got to be such a charged issue that it became one of those, well, if you think it's really bad, there must be something really exciting about it. And that I really want one, and that I really want to play that one. If you say a certain behavior is not appropriate, but other people do it, well, that's why every time at dinner time we ask Peter if he's thankful for something, he's thankful for the police, or soldiers, or war.
God, that's a new one.
I just want to suggest that you should be true to yourself. If you're a feminine style communicator, go ahead and be one. And when your child gets old enough, then say to her, oh, isn't that interesting how he responded here? Look at how he dealt with this situation or this confrontation. This is how it was resolved. But be true to yourself and the kind of person you are, because you try to be something you're not. She's going to pick up on that also.
But I think I'm also very assertive, and I think I'm a lot of other things
that
I have spent. No, but I think that I've spent a lot of time not communicating in that way because I felt like it was inappropriate. So I've learned to be comfortable with a style of communicating that I don't think reflects probably the wholeness of who I am. That's what I'm trying to say. I didn't mean to make myself an example. Yeah.
Just real briefly, you and I have talked about sort of forgetting the words masculine and feminine and starting to think about what sorts of characteristics would we like to see in our kids.
Right, you know, just
what
period.
What would you like the kids to be?
Strong.
And where are they going to learn those characteristics? Where are they going to learn that dance? Is it going to be from a complementary match set of a masculine and feminine style, you know, no matter who that comes from? Is it going to come from, I mean, what if the child has two dads or two moms? You know, you learn these kinds of things in so many different ways now. Single parents, no parents. You ever heard of kids who go to homes where they are never really officially adopted, but they're in effect raised by that family because their own situations are terrible? So then all these different ways we learn things, if we can drop the titles and just look at the qualities, go one level more concrete and see what it is we want through the dance, maybe that's a good way to move.
Yeah, I mean, as we were talking yesterday, you know, like maybe rename them blue and green.
Yeah.
That might get rid of some of the value-laden pieces of that. Don't we all want to be strong? Don't we all want strong children? Don't we all want to be nurturing? Don't we all want children who can nurture themselves and others? We're really close to being out of time. Your clock's different than mine.
Believe yours.
What?
Believe yours.
Okay. But the two other questions I wanted to talk about, but then I do want to do a quick tie-up, is that I wanted to talk about today, and I want all of us, you know, these are just things to think about as you go. One is, as you've talked about, I mean, TV and all of those sorts of things. Also, the girls who learn they can play sports but still need to be pretty. the, you know, the boys who are creative and imaginative and gentle, but who are afraid of gay bashing, and people who don't fit into those gendered stereotypes and all the damage we do there. So how do you want to counter those? And I heard, you know, the church as being a place that can help do that. Our homes, as we parent other people's children and our own, how do we do that? And think about that. The other one is the broader question, and I think one that is important to not miss, and I'm sort of sorry we're not going to get to it, but is how do we advocate for these changes at a broader level? We can all say we want to change them within our own lives and work for those, but how do we carry them out? How do we get them into our church? How do we get our church to take seriously how we're going to offer role modeling for our children and how we're going to break down some of these stereotyped roles and help people reach their fullness and their wholeness? How do we get our legislators to stop making laws and doing things that keep us separate along lines that are, as I think we've sort of come to as the week goes on, pretty arbitrary? We've named them, we've given them a lot of power, but now we need to look at how we can all be more whole, I think. I guess, did you want to make a parting comment? Do people want to make some closing? I hate to go. This has been a good conversation, and I'd like to continue. But our people, we only have a couple of minutes, and if the bell rings and somebody needs to go, go.
I think there are some of us here who don't know how much change we really want to make. I mean, the old ways have served our generation, and who's to say that we should throw them all out?
Well, then maybe make change in that direction. I mean, it doesn't sound like anybody's really happy with where we're sitting right now. So we don't necessarily need to move to the left. You could move to the right. I mean, what are you prepared to do?
I guess I see all kinds of inputs here, but I don't see any consensus that one way is better than another and that people need to come that much closer. We can't all be unisex or anything. I guess this is just a personal conclusion.
Yeah.
I think in our case, we are the living role models for our children, and for us to try to instill something in them that isn't really us and a real part of us, I think it's a little bit artificial. We felt that we wanted to be sincere and to set the role that was important to us in our life. Mm-hmm. And basically, we did the best we could.
Exactly.
Given the model that we were doing. Mm-hmm. And that's as much as we can do.
Right. Oh, and I don't, I'm sorry if you heard it as saying people should be other way.
I wanted to make
other
point
than
that basically we are the role model. If we want to do something different for our children, we're still a role model, and it may come across artificially.
Right. And I guess I'm advocating that we all become as whole as we can be so that the model our children get is as whole as it can be.
In that regard, role model, if the role model of an individual, a father or mother, were sort of put together mm-hmm. like dad did the dishes, I mean, the simplest explanation I can come up with.
Uh-huh.
And mom went out and maybe trimmed the lawn. Mm-hmm. Within something within the scope. But if our offspring or the children that see us as, quote, role model, see that I'm doing some of the things that I expect she had done forever and I assumed she'd do forever, I'm doing it. Uh-huh. Then maybe that's the way to enter into this to ultimately get where there are two, sure, or there's one, fine. Mm-hmm. But we understand that we're capable in both areas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Wes, I don't know if you want to speak to it. I mean, I appreciated Wes's contributions this week, especially around saying, you know, that the Gospels have all pieces there. Jesus wasn't just a caring person who nurtured and cared for people and took care of them. Jesus was also a person who challenged the authorities as they stood. That we do have a role model within our tradition of a person who was whole, who had all pieces, and that we're not sort of grabbing at stars to try to come up with something to look at to give us an example of ways we could be. And I just thought that was a wonderful contribution from Wes for me this week, that we can, I mean, our tradition has it for us. We're not making this up. We're not starting from scratch, is my opinion.
What?
And I did a tentative thing right there.
Oh, you did.
So, I don't know, if you want to say something, we really should close, so we can go get to our...
We really should close.
Thank you all.
Thank you.